So I'm gonna talk to you today about some aspects of my field work here in Brazil, and it's mostly about the work I do with peripheral communities in Rio. So just I'll start with some background, some theory, but it's gonna be very quick because I think the very exciting and interesting part of my talk will be the data, and then we'll try to make sense of the data. And I'm really happy to hear about you. It's work I've been doing for more than a decade, so it's great to have a specialized audience from another part of the world. So that will be interesting. So, a lot of what I'm gonna talk is published in this book. I published earlier this year with my colleague Jerry Lee, and you can download it for free from the publisher. And I'm gonna try to unpack what we are meaning by seeing language as hope. So, this phrase, social linguistics of hope, is sort of a collective phrase that some colleagues and I, Rodrigo Borba, Jerry Lee, and others are putting together. One of the first theoretical sources for this is this very interesting book by a philosopher, Jonathan Lear, who studied the devastation of a form of life. It's he went to the historical record of what happened to the Crow people in the United States. They were a nomad group who suffered this collapse because they were confined into a reservation by the US government. So a lot of their forms of life and their rituals and other resources sort of lost meaning because they were related to their previous way of life. So Lear talks about this collapse of frameworks, but also of their reinvention. And he called it radical hope, which was a way that the community devised to sort of circumvent despair and propel more livable lives. So, on the basis of this case, and which relates to so many other cases in the world, we are calling the social linguistics of hope this form of imagining the connection between talk or signs in general and social processes, which is a definition for language ideology. And this can happen in places where people face things like uncertainty, precarity, or violence. So, basically, sociolinguistically, people who engage with hope, they recalibrate time, space, language, and other resources to bypass paralysis and despair. So, as you see, hope is not something related to this passive waiting for utopic reality to come, but actual language and material work. So I'm going to talk about Rio. I'm sure most of you know it. It's a very iconic city, but it's also the name of the state of Rio. It's the second major city in Brazil, and it has a long history. It was a capital of the Republic of Brazil, which is the form of government we have now. But Brazil was a Portuguese colony, so it was also the capital of the Portuguese colony, one of the only colonized spaces that were the capital of the colony itself, because the king had to flee Napoleon. It was also the capital of the Kingdom of Brazil after that, when the monarchy became independent here. It's a very large population, more than 6 million people, and 22% of the people live in the areas I do work in, which are the favelas. Here, just some images, just so you see the location of the favelas. Many of them are near these central wealthy neighborhoods because they were built in hills by descendants of enslaved people in Brazil. They, when the monarchy ended slavery, they did not grant the freed people with any kind of policy for housing, jobs. So people had to find their own ways to create their living, their houses, and everything else. And so a lot of the inequality and the violence against minorities are disproportionately targeting this population who are descendants of the people who were brutally treated in the past. So just some data about you see, for example, the race divisions in Brazil. And for example, in the state of Rio, in this first table, so for example, whites are 47% of the population, and negros, racial classifications here are a bit complex. So negro is a category involving black people who are darker people, but also mixed race people like me. And for example, there are 51% of the people in Rio. But if you go to the table on the right, you see that, for example, in relation to the people who are suffer like lethal violence, whites represent 14% of the people, but negros 86%. So you see how disproportionate things are in racial terms of those who are most likely to be targets of violence. So a lot of my work has to do with this relation between violence and culture, violence and language, but recently some scholars in sociolinguistics, applied linguistics, have been more and more interested in this relation, and they're using this framework, which is quite interesting, this idea of securitization, which is this process by which certain issues or subjects in a society are framed as security threats. And it involves constructing a narrative that justifies the use of extraordinary measures or policies to address perceived enemies. So this idea of securitization is not the same as security, as one would say in terms of human rights, the right to live in a safe environment, but more this political idea of using this notion of security as exception to frame a particular group. And across the world, it varies a lot, but in general, this group is a racial minority or immigrant group, etc. Scholars have also talked about insecuritization because, as Ben Rampton and Dina Charalambo say, security to one person can be insecurity to another. And here we see a scene in a favela, you know, people coming from the school, and you see this, that's this notion of securitization in Brazil can mean insecurity to some people. Just a very, very quick history of this paradigm in Brazil. So in Brazil, in the 80s, there is this escalation of violent crime, and it's a lot of it is related to the transnational drug traffic and to the dynamics that start to happen in the society, and a lot of the trade of the retail trade takes place in peripheries, so that causes some violence in the streets. And there is this dispute between the world of crime, people who are related to these illegal activities, and the state. This division is not a binary one, because the state is somehow also involved with the world of crime. I will give an example later. And this is in the images. This is a, if you are interested, this is an interesting series on Netflix about one of the crime factions in Brazil that is kind of has the monopoly of that trade in the state of São Paulo. So, as you may know, Brazil also has a totalitarian populace related to people like Viktor Orban and Donald Trump, Jair Bolsonaro, and he was elected with a agenda of securitization, so to speak. So it was this Christian and law and order discourse, and he, for example, deregulated guns as much as he could, and a lot of people were elected on his wave, so to speak. So below him, you see Witzel, who was elected governor of Rio, and the picture tells a lot. So he's saying something like, the police will target the little heads of the quote-unquote criminals and fire. And you see this newspaper picture of those who are framed criminals. So you see it's basically young black males. And Bolsonaro has connections with the world of crime through the milicias, which are these paramilitary groups in mostly in Rio. And his family has been related to them for decades. So I showed a quite a bleak scenario. Rio is such a beautiful city, but has is entangled with this scenario. But I don't want to talk about any bleak stuff. So I want to talk to you about how the activists I follow react to this scenario. So I'm going to talk a little bit about the resources that they resort to. So, for example, education activism, this idea of counter security, which is a resistance to securitization, and identity work, their valorization of local language forms, styles, and other things. So I mostly do work with these three collectives, the Instituto Raízes em Movimento and Coletivo Papo Reto, which are in Complexo do Alemão, this group of favelas. You see a clip where you can see some of it. And the Instituto Marielle Franco, which is became very influential politically. It was a collective created after the assassination of the councilwoman Marielle Franco in Rio. Her sister is now a minister of racial relations in the Lula government. And Marielle and the people in this collective have been, Marielle was, and the people have been related to these other collectives. They're part of a broader network. So I just want to show, this is a very short clip, and it tells something about how things are affected in daily life by these normative regimes that are in conflict, so to speak, the police and the drug traffic. So this was an interview. We were in Complexo do Alemão, in this favela in Rio, and the interview was interrupted twice, the first time by drug dealers, a scout who was near us, and Rafael Calazans, our interlocutor, got kind of nervous when he noticed that. And this is another agent interfering in the conversation. So this is, maybe you haven't heard much, but I hope you could follow the subtitles. So in this very short scene, you see how the very presence of this armed agent interferes with the talk. So Calazans was going smoothly and like talking about different things. And then when he sees them, he produces some sort of incoherent phrase. He went to buy the noise, which was basically just a filler for, you know, the scene he was seeing. And so I think this tells a lot about how insecurity affects people's everyday lives. But what I want to say here, and this next clip is going to give evidence to that, is that people do not reduce their lives to that. So this was the same interview, and Calazans was elaborating on this notion of cultural survival, which tells a lot about what the book I wrote with Jerry talks about. So, yeah, it's very interesting that this clip tells a lot about the dialogues, not only internal to the favela. Calazans is elaborating on the cooperation that people relied on to sort of bypass precarity and precarious policies through the community. So, for example, people didn't have water, electricity, so residents would find their way and do the gatos, you know, these cats, which is a slang for some sort of non-conventional or illegal connection. But it's also interesting that, you know, a lot of the activists we engage with are connected to the university. Calazans was a social work student at the time. So he's also drawing on his own academic knowledge on notions such as survival and interpreting his everyday life on that. So it's very interesting to think of these cooperations, not only between community members themselves, but also of, you know, them and other social groups, for example, academics and intellectuals. So I'm going to talk very briefly about the work, this counter-security work that people in this collective do, the Coletivo Papo Reto. Papo Reto translates as straight talk. Some of them are related to that other collective, the Raízes em Movimento. Calazans was part of this collective for a while, but no longer. And it's very interesting how they elaborate. So Calazans was elaborating on semiotic resources, and here they're elaborating on language itself, on register, on a register, which is this notion of Papo Reto. So you see there, one of the pictures they have on social media is this one where they're wearing dictionary entry on this slang phrase, papo reto, which, by the way, doesn't exist in sort of normative conventional dictionaries in Portuguese. So it's very interesting how they elaborate on this notion of being straightforward, but also you've seen the definitions that definition four is a definition of themselves as a collective. So it's very interesting to see this work of valorization of local styles. And they also sort of bridge this valorization of styles, language styles, but also other semiotic styles, but with this notion of counter security. So I will show also a clip where you see this connection between style, sociolinguistic style, and counter security in this podcast talk that Raul Santiago, one of the activists in this collective, gave. So it's very interesting that he's speaking about the formation of the collective and how they sort of gathered resources and people to work towards a cause. Yeah, so you see in this collective that something different emerges that wasn't quite clear in the other piece of data that I showed from Calazans, which is the use of digital technologies to, in how terms, monitor what's going on in Complexo do Alemão. And I think it's also very interesting in this clip, this notion of communication of balance, which is to sort of denounce the violence using, you know, social mobile phones and social media, but also showing what he calls the potencia, the potency, and valorizing local life forms, which is very interesting because it shows that they're actively trying to avoid this stereotype of living, inhabiting a violent place. So, and it's very interesting the use of some, you know, resources like laughter. So, for example, he says that monitoring violence results from a cutting-edge technology by NASA, which is a WhatsApp group. But I mean, in Brazil, people use WhatsApp a lot, especially groups. So they sort of tailor that for circulating information about happenings, about shootouts, etc. And it's very interesting, this laughter and informality, which are very characteristics of peripheral communities in Brazil. And it's interesting how that can be a resource for digital action, for counter-securitization, because their aim was to challenge the, for example, the narratives, the official narratives about the community, about who, for example, perpetrated a crime, and they're with the technologies, they can show a different thing. And also this balance as counter-securitization, not only of denouncing that, but also valorizing blackness and refusing the violent stigma that falls upon them. So the educational activism is pretty visible in the work of Mariluce Maria, who is another activist in Complexo do Alemão. She isn't connected to any collectives, but she does engage with them. My colleague, Juno Maia, wrote a dissertation on her work. So she paints the little houses in the community, the graffitis, especially on walls, but she also does like real paintings, canvases, and she teaches that to children. And there is this event where we launched a book in 2019, and Juno and her wrote a chapter together. And in the book talk, she was elaborating on a very high-profile event that happened there. One of her students in the painting classes was shot by the police, and apparently accidentally, but that was very difficult for everyone. And it's interesting the way she elaborates that. She says, yesterday I had two girls at my house, Ana Carolina and Nicole, who's Agatha's cousin. Agatha was the girl who was shot. Then they said, auntie, it will be Children's Day and she won't even be with us. And the worst would be when I get out of the church and I want to dance, won't be able to dance because mommy will go to heaven, daddy will go to heaven, and I'll be here. And I said, if you stay, don't worry, because I'll stay with you. Even if everybody goes to hell, I will stay with you because I also dance, I drink, I do everything that the church says I can't do. I am evangelical, but faith has to be inside me. So we don't have time to elaborate on that, but it's very interesting, for example, how she brings religion, which is something very conspicuous, you know, in Brazil in general. But in the favela, more so, evangelicals are growing and growing in these communities. But it's interesting how she uses this discourse as a way to interpret the reality and sort of project it very progressively. And it's very interesting, the reimagination of time, because the children are afraid of, you know, dying or their parents dying because they dance funk, which is a criminalized music style. And she sort of reinterprets that and says, well, even if I die, I will stay, you know? So it's something that's very interesting. So we see this as sort of orientation to hope, this reimagination of language, time, space, etc. Mariluce also did some sort of digital work on denouncing violence. So, for example, she used to post on her social media these alerts of shootouts in the community, which she called digital rockets. I published a paper with Juno Maia on this. And I'm going towards the end of my talk, and it's very interesting to see how to think of cooperation, how other agents outside the favela have been in very productive dialogues with the people in the community. And for example, Cecilia Oliveira, who's a very major journalist in Brazil, she works for The Intercept, and I engaged in a few conversations with her in the community and outside. And she basically saw these grassroots use of technologies, literacies through, for example, map what's going on, shootouts that are used for protection of the community. And with her own networks, she created this Fogo Cruzado, or Crossfire app. Here you can see it. It works pretty much like Waze, and users can insert information about shots, about other violent events, and it helps users to navigate certain areas, which is pretty much what the collectives are doing with social media more informally. But what's more important is that this app is connected to an institute that she was able to create, and they gather a very interesting database about violence, which they use to challenge official numbers. So Cecilia has discussed this with many institutional actors, including the Supreme Court in Brazil. So it's very interesting to see how this grassroots work can be scaled. So we see some scaling up of that. So for example, you see on the left, Aniele Franco, the sister of Marielle Franco. I didn't have to elaborate on her. The councilwoman was assassinated. Aniele became a minister. And on the right, you see some members of the collective Papo Reto with the then Minister of Justice in Lula's government, Flavio Dino. He is now Supreme Court judge. So it's very interesting how these grassroots actions can spread to other spheres of social life, including institutional politics. So just to conclude, on the face of a rather bleak political and historical scenario, reactions of people may be multiple. People may be silent, they may be fearful, they may paralyze themselves. But I follow activists who instead raise their voices and denounce this state of affairs, even if at great personal risk. The activists we studied, they engage with hope as a method, that is, as a form of reorienting knowledge, reorienting time, as in the case of Mariluce, or reorienting technologies, language, as we saw in the Coletivo Papo Reto and in Calazans' work. And they insist on reinventing everyday life through reimagining language, cooperation, anti-racist education, identity work, and counter-security. So hoping this social formation is this not passive waiting, but it's work, it's an active work. And their semiotic work produces multiple effects, including projecting more democratic security and politics. Okay, I think I've made it maybe a little longer than the time, and I thank you all for watching and being here.